This is Terrence McNally. You're listening to one of my favorite previously recorded interviews with David Kirk, author of Kids First, and originally aired in July 2011. What is good enough for a child you love? What's good enough parenting? Good enough early education? Good enough health care? Good enough schools? Good enough support for college? Today's guest, David Kirk, envisions an effort to support and develop our nation's children based on a simple but powerful golden rule. Every child deserves what's good enough for a child you love. His Kids First agenda takes two exceptions to much of the current thinking and policy. First, while most policy for children focuses on K-12 classrooms, research makes clear that what happens before kindergarten and after school each day is at least as important in their development. Second, while programs for children usually concentrate on helping the very poorest, Kirk argues that in this era of underperforming public schools, budget cuts, and two-worker families, America's middle class also needs help. Not only that, but programs for the poor are constantly under threat. Programs that serve the wider public are more sustainable. In Kids First, he offers on-the-ground accounts of initiatives that work and that could affordably be implemented in communities everywhere to achieve these five key priorities. 1, strong support for new parents. 2, high-quality early education. 3, linking schools and communities to improve what both offer children. 4, giving all kids access to a caring and stable adult mentor. And 5, providing kids a nest egg to help pay for college or kickstart a career. David Kirk is a professor at the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He taught at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, was founding director of the Harvard Center on Law and Education. He served on President Obama's transition team. He's a former associate editor of the Sacramento Bee and a syndicated columnist. His books include The Sandbox Investment, The Preschool Movement, and Kid First Politics, Shakespeare, Einstein, and The Bottom Line, The Marketing of Higher Education, and his latest, the one we're going to focus on today, Kids First, Five Big Ideas for Transforming Children's Lives and America's Future. Welcome, David Kirk.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay. I want listeners to get to know the people behind the work and the ideas that we deal with in the show. So you've taken some twists and turns in your career. Law school, journalism, academia. Briefly, could you talk about your path to the work that you're doing today, and feel free to include mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing?
Well, I've always had a passion for improving education and improving kids' lives. That goes back a long ways. And I think, if I think back to mentors, it was really a high school teacher, a renegade Irishman named Bill Grady, a strong Democrat in a staunchly right-wing town out in Long Island, who really opened my eyes to the possibilities of a larger world. He was both a great teacher and a great mentor. And amazingly enough, I'm old enough to remember that as a high school junior, as a 16-year-old kid, he organized a summer program which included visits from amazing people, and we spent the last day of that seminar, a picnic on a lawn of a lovely house about an hour and a half north of New York City, entertained by a wonderful old woman who was near the end of her life, a woman named Eleanor Roosevelt.
Wow.
So for a 16-year-old kid, pretty heady stuff. It is true that all along the way, there were people who showed me the power of tutoring, mentoring, help, individual connection. In college, it was a professor named Leo Marks, who teaches, still writes about American Studies. He's one of the founders of the American Studies field. And I learned a lot about how to think about the world, about how important it was to connect the different pieces, not just to worry about the politics or the economics or the literature, but to figure out ways of putting those together to make a coherent piece in this universe. And when I started, when I graduated from law school, it was Vietnam wartime, and I was fortunate enough to persuade a draft board that teaching teachers and teaching administrators was a job that was having, worth doing even at a time when there was a war going on. And it really was a right place, right time moment. This was a period when kids had essentially no legal rights. If they spoke Spanish on the playground, they were kicked out of school. If those kids who were supposed to be getting compensatory education, additional money from Washington, weren't seeing that money, which was going to carpet principals' offices. Some schools received, poor schools and poor communities received, $1 for every $8, $7, the richest school districts in the state. Kids were kicked out of school, with no due process whatsoever, just on the say-so of a teacher. It was an amazing time, and I really, because of my interest in education and the fact that I was in law school, stumbled into that domain. Again, there was a mentor, someone who I guess still is a mentor in my life, who'd been in Washington, working for the Civil Rights Commission, and with whom I had a kind of Oxford tutorial. I'd write and think and bring stuff to him, and out of that came a paper, which was published by the Harvard Education Review. And so Center for Law and Education, a national center, in pretty uncharted terrain. There was really nobody around in the field, and so this 24-year-old kid wound up with a budget of $2 million, which, in today's money is probably about four or five, and a staff of 10 lawyers, and we raised hell in very good ways and did really, really amazing work. I wound up at Berkeley. At the time, thinking that 3 years was what a career consisted of, I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. I hadn't wanted to be a professor. Turned the interest in policy into a book that's still used in law schools. It's now in its fifth edition, in Education Policy and Law. And as you suggested, it sort of had a don't try this at home kids sort of career. The door closes. So that's meant thinking and writing and working on a whole array of social policy questions, AIDS and gender and community, development of community, but always coming back to kids, always with a passion for kids, always been an involvement as myself, a mentor, an advisor, someone who really cares about teaching, really proud of the fact that I won the Distinguished Teaching Award at Berkeley. And everything that I've worked on has sort of emerged from happenstance. I was a dean for a year at the policy school, and that prompted me to sort of look at how different higher education had become, how much more market-driven it was. And then a walk on the beach and learning about some of the amazing aspects of preschool from a pediatrician got me down that road.
You know what, David? We are having a lot of breakup on your phone line. I'm going to let you wrestle that out with my engineer while I bring people up to speed on what we're talking about.
Okay.
I'm Terrence McNally, speaking with David Kirp, authors of Kids First, the five big ideas for transforming children's lives and America's future. And to learn more, you can go to berkeley.edu or huffingtonpost.com and then type in David Kirp, K-I-R-P. And you can pull up his – he has a page at Berkeley, of course, and then he's lately doing a lot of contributing to the Huffington Post. So berkeley.edu or huffingtonpost.com. This is Free Forum on KPFK, 90.7 FM, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, streaming and podcasting at kpfk.org. And you can visit me at terrencemcnally.net. Or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. TerrenceMcNally.net is TerrenceMcNally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're both the same website. To learn more about the show, guests, podcasts, transcripts, and so on, you can listen to podcasts there or at iTunes. You can sign up there or at iTunes to have it delivered to you weekly. And you can also sign up there or by emailing me at TEMCNALLY at mac.com to sign up for my weekly email in which I tell you who's going to be on and what we're going to talk about and usually a couple of articles on the issues we're going to discuss. People who do get that email I get a lot of feedback that they really enjoy it, and it reminds them, you know, to later tune into the podcast if they happen to miss the show. So here we are. I hope we've fixed up the phone issue, and David
Kerr.
So
as well.
Yeah. Yeah,
I was in the middle of a too long peroration on life. And
well,
time,
no.
It's a what, rare opportunity. It's
yeah,
a pleasure.
Exactly. What I can tell you is that I've been doing this now for 15 years, and any number of people. I mean, believe me, when I ask them about their path, what's remarkable is that so often it is those accidental moments, those things, like for instance, something you did because there was a war going on. Leads you in a certain direction. The notion, and I say this to young people, I hope young people listen to this, because the notion that you lay out a plan as a blueprint and follow it, and that's the way to success, that works for some people, but time and again, people who have made significant contributions to society took a very circuitous route to doing it.
It's indeed true. I mean, everything that I've done has really been the result of some kind of happenstance. Something happened, I learned about something, I had a conversation with something, I wound up in a job, I was asked to give a talk, somebody came to me and said, can you help out with this problem? And that led to pretty significant investment of time and energy and passion.
Right. And that's actually been my own experience as well. So let's move up to the near future, because again, I believe my question is, how did this book happen? But I know from reading and listening to other interviews you've done that part of it is one of those happenstance things.
Well, it is. I'm one of those academics who thinks that my job only really begins when I've written a book, that the book is a ticket of admission to a larger national conversation, and that I really want to be useful, not just to be published. So what that meant was, after writing about preschool and the sandbox investment, I spent a ton of time traveling around the country talking to state legislators and business leaders and community leaders. And out of that experience was asked to serve on the transition team to work mainly on early education, but more generally on education issues. And by the way, I'm very happy to report that last week the program that we devised, that we worked at, we fleshed out in that transition, an early learning challenge grant program, is now on the books. There's a $500 million program. So even in these miserable budget times, something very good has happened.
Very good. I was going to certainly ask about that towards the end. So let me also ask you, because one of the things you do in this book is you look at the child as a person, not the child as a fifth grade student or the child is a disadvantaged three-year-old, but the child is a whole person. And your approach in the five big ideas in Kids First definitely take that approach, that we are dealing with a human being here.
Absolutely. And that really also comes out of the transition. We talked to 150 different groups, and they were all excited about some or another aspect of kids. You know, it's kids' literacy or math or Head Start or child care or Catholic education or 4-H or whatever. But there really wasn't anybody who was speaking for thinking about the kid, really the child, you know, growing from birth to the time that he or she would be thinking about college or career. And that is, you know, the part of me that's a policy wonk said, okay, what kind of policies might give you a system of supports that, as you were suggesting, satisfies, and I think it was the policy version of the Golden Rule, something that you'd want for your own kid, something that you'd want for a child that you love.
Okay. And I want to talk about those two points that I brought up in the introduction, where I said that your approach varies from conventional wisdom or practice. And the first was that while most policy for children focuses on the classroom, you focus on before he goes to school, after he comes home from school, summers between school, and where he's going to go after school. I mean, after he finishes school. And the second one is most policy conversations, most programs, certainly where the government is involved, focus on the poorest. And you argue that's not such a sound idea. Could you talk about those two distinctions?
Sure. I want to start by saying that I would never argue about the centrality of importance of the school. It's where kids are. It's the core institution in their lives. But what's happened to the conversation about children is that it's become just about schooling. I mean, it's that battle between the market forces, the people who brought us Waiting for Superman on the one side, and those who just sort of take them on and regard that view of the world as the demon. And I'm thinking about Diane Ravitch on the other side of the story. And while I certainly am much more in Diane Ravitch's camp, it seems to me that both of them really miss the larger point, that it is the child, beginning with, you know, the child in the family, and then the child in early education, and then the child, as you say, not just during those 6 hours a day when the focus is on the 3 hours, but in the before and after school in summers that matters. And we can get into this later, but it matters hugely in terms, not just because it's nice stuff, but in terms of how it is that a child turns out, what the child can learn, and just the rest of his or her life, what kind of emotional as well as intellectual development is going on in a child's life. So that's where those five ideas, you know, take as a given that there's going to be an academically rigorous, eye-opening, problem-driven as opposed to memorization-driven education. But that's the given. The question is, what else ought to go on?
Right.
And it really is what else ought to go on for all kids. And I feel, and not just poor kids. And I believe that for a whole bunch of reasons. One of them, as you suggested, is that, you know, increasingly now, middle-class families are under siege. But even you know, if you take us out of this time, it's the case that it's not as though they're just problems that poor kids have and that middle-class families or kids are miraculously free from them. You look at the beginning of school, for example, poor children come to school way behind academically in middle-class counterparts. But the middle-class kids are just as far behind the wealthiest kids on the block. What's more, there are more of them, more just in terms of numbers,
right.
more middle-class kids who've got the array of problems that we'd care about. Now, it's important to get the priorities clear. Because the needs are greatest for poor kids at a time of limited resources, that's where you start. But the goal really is all children and not just a handful of children, not just the poorest children in the society. I think that's morally important because, you know, children are individuals, they're not just rich people and poor people. I think it's a measure of a good society that it pays attention to all of its citizens, even as it concentrates its concerns on the neediest. And as a practical political matter, if you focus on the poor, whether they're kids, as in the compensatory education programs, or whether it's grown-ups, as in programs like Medicare, you're going to get shortchanged every time.
Let me see. Did you mean Medicaid?
I did. I'm sorry. Medicaid.
Because Medicare is the examples.
Medicare is the count. Medicare and Social Security are the counter
example.
You know, when Republican Congressman Paul Ryan came up with his Medicare, you know, destruction plan, that was to the Democrats the gift that would keep on giving and will keep on giving through the 2012 election, whereas it's very hard to get people to pay any attention to the gutting of Medicaid.
Exactly.
That we've never, whether it's Head Start or the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, compensatory education dollars, there's never been enough because we, in quotes, are not willing to make generous contributions to them, in quotes.
That's right.
Whereas if it's us, if we see ourselves as in the same boat, everybody winds up being better off.
Yeah.
The poor even are better off because the citizenry is that much more generous in its support.
Right. I mean, and if we go back to the origin of the public school, to go back, you know, quite a ways in history, but the early stages of the conversation we're having now, that was something that was for everyone.
Absolutely. It was the common school, what one of the leaders of that time, Horace Mann, called the balance wheel of the social machinery. And the hope is that you'd develop institutions good enough that all families
right.
would take advantage of them.
Right, and this was much more the case when you and I were in school. Let me tell people, I'm Terrence McNally, I'm speaking with David Kerp. He's the author of Kids First, Five Big Ideas for Transforming Children's Lives and America's Future. And you can learn more about David's work and ideas either by going to berkeley.edu or huffingtonpost.com and then typing in David Kerp, K-I-R-P. Let's shift to those five big ideas. The first one is parenting and family support. What does that mean? Who's doing it? What difference does it make?
So when I was thinking my way through what a Kids First agenda, I was looking for game changers, that is, things that would really make a huge difference in the lives of children, the lives of all children. I was looking for ideas that had some good basis and evidence. They weren't just dreamy notions, but that they'd been tried out, and for ideas that you actually could apply broadly. They weren't hothouse notions that could only exist for a handful of folks. And I started with parenting for the obvious reasons that parents are kids' first and most important influence in how it is that they turn out in life. And I've never met a parent who said, gee, I've got it locked. I don't need any advice. I don't need it. I can, just go away. Leave me alone. I got it. Rich parents, middle-class parents, poor parents, they're all trying and they're all struggling in one way, shape, or form. And the best of parenting programs aren't those that concentrate on poor kids. They're those that give to anybody that a parent would come to for advice, a social worker, a minister, a rabbi, a teacher, a school principal, a counselor, anybody that a parent would think to turn to, the tools to really help that parent deal with the array of real live, honest-to-God problems that they encounter. My child won't sleep, my child won't eat, my child is eating too much, my child screams, gets into fights, isn't doing well in school, or I've got a child who's developmentally delayed, I don't know how to handle that. And that training, and this, by the way, is a program that exists countrywide in places like Britain and Australia, other parts of the world. It's been tested, there are 20-odd tests meeting the gold standard for research. What happens then is there's a lot of social marketing goes on. So here's this community. There are a number of places across the country that are now doing this. Here's this community that's got all this talent, and now you're going to get the word out to parents. The minister stands up in the pulpit. The teacher talks about this in school. Sends home some information to the parents, and then word of mouth takes over. And the changes are huge, and they're not one-by-one changes. They're community-wide changes.
And are you talking about Triple P, Positive Parenting Program?
No, I'm talking about Triple P, the Positive okay. Parenting Program, which, if there were – I think the agenda, thinking about the agenda is crucial because it's about – the synergies is about connections.
Right.
At a time when there's no money – out there, or it's felt that there's no money out there. In addition to Triple P being a powerful, changer of behaviors and norms, it's really cheap. Because what we're talking about is giving professionals in the field and just folks in the field that parents turn to a set of tools, and then letting them use those as part of their practice, as part of their daily life. The estimate is that once you get that program up and running, you're talking about $15 a child. So even per child.
For the year or for life?
No, for, period.
Wow.
Period, in terms
okay.
of what the program, we're talking about a program that, because what you're doing is you're training the professionals and they're reaching the kids. And the kinds of supports we're talking about aren't just for the youngest kids. They begin with problems that parents of newborns have and they take you right through age 10 or 12, through the issues of early adolescence.
So when you say this,
very impressive program.
Yeah, when you say this program costs $15 a child, and that gives everyone who might want to intervene with a child just better knowledge and better skills and so on, it seems that the issue and why this isn't everywhere must just be that people don't know about it. I think you described it as the least known success story or something.
I think that's right, and I'm not out there shilling for any program. I want the best to happen for kids, and so I've talked to the people who've been developing this program, so you've got to do a better job getting the word out.
Yeah.
And the word is now getting out, finally.
Okay, and we're doing our part right now. I'm Terrence McNally speaking with David Kerp about his book, Kids First, Five Big Ideas for Transforming Children's Lives and America's Future. And at the towards the end of the program, I'm going to leave time for us to talk about how this does impact America's future. Let me hear you tell us a bit about a couple of other programs, the Nurse Family Partnership.
Yep. Well, the Nurse Family Partnership has been in operation since the 1970s when a then-young pediatrician thought that parents, particularly parents of poor kids and particularly first-time parents, needed the constant connection to not just anybody, but a trained nurse, someone who understood a program that really focused on child development, gave parents cues to address the array of issues that kids had as they were growing up. And the program begins during pregnancy, and indeed a condition for a parent to participate in the program is that they do so before the end of the second trimester and continues to the age of two. And that parent and that nurse get together weekly during that time. And the parent is learning an enormous array of skills. I went out with some of the nurses. I mean, a lot of, you know, what I learned comes from actually being on the ground, talking
sure.
to people, watching stuff happening. And, you know, again, if you think that you know a lot about parenting, just a lesson on how it is to pick up kids' facial cues, the cues that say, there's going to be a meltdown unless you, you know, just it's just on the horizon, so you here are ways that you can deal with it. Amazingly impressive, sophisticated stuff. And it makes a difference. It makes a difference in the long term. That program has also been well studied. The kids' lives are different, and the parents' lives are different. They tend to be, they're teen moms. They tend to be more likely to space out the kids over a longer period of time. They report that they're happier, they're healthier, their kids are certainly healthier, do better in the school, are less likely to get in trouble with the law than similar kids who haven't had that experience.
And so I think what I would love people to hear here is this is from pregnancy to the age of two, and it makes a difference. The studies are longitudinal. The studies, I think, have taken kids through high school, if not beyond. And the what you do then makes a huge difference. However, I want to add that what you make clear in this book is that you can't just front load everything. You can't just give kids help in the before school and hope that will pay off for everyone. That it really is this idea of staying with them throughout. But that's an what are the
Let me just stay with that for 1 second.
Yeah.
Because it's not as though this is not a world of triple P versus
right.
Nurse Family Partnership. The one fits very nicely into the other. It's a great tool to have, and those parents who are fortunate enough to participate in triple P get a great experience. But they are few in number necessarily. It's a very expensive program. It's an $8,000 to $10,000 a year program. And as you noted, ends at age two. And it's not as though child rearing ends at age two.
Okay, we're going to take a brief break here now, and we'll be right back with David Kerp talking about Kids First, Five Big Ideas for Transforming Children's Lives and America's Future.
Harris with you, inviting you to join me at my all-new time, Mondays 2 to 3. That's Mondays 2 to 3 here on KPFK 90.7 FM. Of course, it's going to be your live calls, breaking news, analysis, and information, and a healthy dose of light at the end of the tunnel. In the meantime, you can always hang with me anytime at GoHarrison.com. That's GoHarrison.com.
Greetings, I'm Chuck Foster. Join me today at 2 o'clock for 2 hours of reggae music on Reggae Central. You'll hear ska, rock steady, reggae, roots and culture, dub and dancehall. You'll hear it all on Reggae Central, today at 2 o'clock.
Okay, and I'm back on Freeform. This is Terrence McNally. This is 90.7 FM KPFK in Los Angeles, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, streaming and podcasting all around the globe at kpfk.org. I'm speaking with David Kerp. We're talking about kids and the notion that underlies the book, underlies this conversation, is that no better investment can we make than to invest in our children. And the way that that investment has shrunk over the last years is costing us big time and will only cost us more in the future. We'll get into that big picture, as I said, towards the end. Nurse-family partnership, which you were just describing, what's the cost, relative cost of that, and how widely is it in practice?
Well, depending upon where you are, what part of it, whether you're in a city or in a rural area, you're talking about $8,000 to $10,000 a year. Because it's a good chunk of a nurse's time, and nurses are highly paid, working with working closely with a family.
So $8,000 to $10,000 per child, per family.
Per child per year.
Wow.
And limit that fact, and the fact that you're relying on nurses limits its spread.
Right. We have a nursing shortage in this country as well.
We do. The ambition of the people who run Nurse Family Partnership is to reach 400,000 or 500,000 parents a year. The ambition of a program like Triple P is to reach all families.
Right. And with Nurse Family Partnership, currently mostly dependent on donations, it's a nonprofit?
Mostly dependent on federal, state, and local funds.
Ah!
Actually are some funds earmarked. There's money for parenting programs that was part of the first spate of legislation during the Obama administration, and a good chunk of that money goes to Nurse Family Partnership.
Okay.
It was really the inspiration for that program, for that federal funding program.
Okay. Again, does its job, needs more funds, needs to reach more people. The second of your big ideas is high-quality early education that helps transition young parents and children from home to school.
A really crucial part of the story. I mean, I think by now, most people have got it, that education doesn't begin when kids go to kindergarten, and then indeed so much has happened in their lives in the years before that. This is when the brain develops fastest. It's also, if you watch kids, what you see is just bundles of curiosity. There's a notion of, you know, kids as empty vessels that you pour knowledge into. I think it's a really bad metaphor. I think of kids as explorers. They're the little Lewis's and Clark's out there in the world. And given the right environment, given the right things that they can explore, given help from a teacher who really understands child development, given the engagement of parents in that process, astonishing progress can be made. And again, I mean, the data is astounding. Long-term studies of really good early education show that, you know, as late as studies that take you to middle age show that by any metric you'd want, you know, staying in school, graduating, going to college, getting a decent job, staying off welfare, staying out of prison, staying healthy, the kids who went to preschool just do astonishingly better. And if you want to translate that into the dollar terms that are so commonly used these days, you're talking about a return of $7 or $8 for every dollar invested. It's the kind of investment that Warren Buffett wishes he could find.
Well, that's gets to my point towards the end of the show, is that, I mean, Mr. Buffett and his other billionaires should be looking at this one, since they're so interested in investment.
Well, Buffett is, actually. I mean, to his credit,
yeah.
You know, interestingly, it's Buffett's kids who went out and have made huge investments.
Great.
In early education.
Great. And I'm just saying that the
right.
I think that notion of investment is the way that I see everything we're talking about framed.
It is. It's also, if you go into a really good preschool program, and those are the best teachers on the planet. They've got eyes on all sides of their head. They design these gardens of earthly delights that, you know, make me wish so much that as a 3- and 4-year-old, that was the kind of experience that I had.
Yeah.
And you can see, you know, I sat through a sat in a you know, an hour devoted to the making of latkes the Hanukkah kind of potato pancakes,
right.
In an all Latino town. And it was fascinating, from just getting a feel for the potato and how it is that you peel it and what boiling does, all the way to the making of those latkes. It was fabulous. And what did they serve with the latkes? Well, sour cream and applesauce, which is what the
right.
Jewish folks serve, and salsa. You know, we are in a Latino community, so welcome to the 21st century. And it was as good teaching as you'll find any place.
And we don't have time to go into a lot of the things that this is taking a hand in, but you, one of the things you point out is that kids, let's say, from disadvantaged homes who don't have access to these sorts of things, they just end up starting school with smaller vocabularies, by a long shot, things like this, that puts them at a disadvantage from the start.
Absolutely, and I mean, poor kids have it worse, particularly if they don't have that kind of help. But middle-class children, you know, whose parents can't afford good preschool, wind up, you know, having their kids, you know, taken care of by the neighbor lady down the road.
That's right.
She may be great, you know, and have a warm heart, but she doesn't know anything about child development, and the kids really suffer. That's why so many middle-class kids.
That's right.
The school behind and, as well.
And that's why I mentioned, I think, at the top of the two-worker family, you know, that now means we know that to attempt to keep up, both parents work and the kids get squeezed. The kids' time with their parents, their time with stimulation, it's just, I mean, that's why I made such a big point at the start about saying this has to be for everyone. One other thing, you say something interesting, and you sort of were alluding to it a bit ago, but you say preschools have a ton to teach elementary schools, middle schools, and high schools briefly.
They're problem-driven. You know, they get kids to think, to work, to solve problems, and they get them to work in groups. They do a lot of different things are going on at the same time. Kids are moving from activity to activity. The learning becomes explicit. It's something that's thought about, talked about. The kids take ownership of what they're doing. They've got a lot to teach, not just elementary school. They've got a lot to teach schooling generally.
Right, because as you know, folks, what happens is all that wonderful collaboration, and as David Kirp said, problem-oriented, we're looking not at a vocabulary but at how we solve a problem, that so much seems to get lost when we move into lines of desks in classrooms, and you're in trouble if you talk to your neighbor.
No, exactly. The farther up you go in the education world, from elementary to middle to high school, the greater the prestige, and overall, the worse the teaching.
Okay. Point three, this is the third big idea in Kids First, five big ideas for transforming children's lives and America's future by David Kirp. Academically rigorous community schools which work to ensure medical care, social services, tutoring, after school, summer, etc.
Exactly. And they exist. There are these schools, just as there are really good early education programs across the country. I mean, the best of them that I found are in Washington Heights, New York. But there's some great ones in Los Angeles that I visited as well, and that I talk about in the book a bit. We're so far past the 8-to-3, 180-day school year in terms of what these kids need. You talked before about families' time being squeezed by work. And what we know from the research is this, that the amount of time that adolescents, for example, spend unsupervised after school is a better predictor of school failure than race or social class. And if you can engage those kids in athletics and art and music and sports and academics, you know, if you can make after school programs exciting, you really do have a huge effect on their lives generally. The same, by the way, true of summer programs in a different way. Poor kids and middle-class kids do about the same during the course of the school year. The difference is in the summers. You know, here, middle and upper middle-class kids have opportunities that just aren't available to the poor kids who are often out in the streets. And so they lose as compared to their middle-class kids.
Yeah, I hope people can hear that during the school year, they're working at the same level, and they fall behind in the summer. I would imagine one could almost say during the school day they're doing things, and certain kids fall behind every night.
No, absolutely, and this is again why after school programs are important things. It's why, you know, you remember Bill Clinton's midnight basketball, for which he was derided. He
right.
was absolutely on the right idea. I mean, you want kids playing basketball, or you want them out there getting in trouble.
Exactly. Let me. I even a quote from one of the folks who's very critical of these sorts of things. In a U.S. News and World Report column in the spring of 2009, Joel Klein, the tough love chancellor of New York City's public schools, mocked the favored solution du jour to reduce the handicap of being poor by establishing full-service health clinics at schools, expanding preschool programs, and offering after-school services, community schools. He said, no single impediment to closing the nation's shameful achievement gap looms larger than the culture of excuse. In other words, saying kids could use that stuff is an excuse for them not performing. Your response?
Yeah, Joel Klein, now the right-hand man for Rupert Murdoch, is the one person who I actually do go after in the book. I'm not a big believer in attacking folks. I'd rather look at the positive side of the coin. But that quote is just appalling. Let's just take the one thing we haven't talked about, which is getting health care.
Right.
So if you take, you know, overall, about 30% of kids come to school with untreated dental problems. That costs $1.5 million school days a year. Kids just can't make it to school. About a third of the kids have uncorrected vision problems. And in inner cities, about 30% of the kids have untreated asthma. So if you just think about it, Joel Klein and anybody else who uses school, if you just think about it, imagine yourself, you can't see the blackboard, you're in pain and you're having a hard time breathing. It's very hard to imagine how you get a kid to concentrate on critical thinking when they're in that condition.
Not only that, but what I hear right as you describe that is, what is the impact on the rest of the class when that one child is in pain, can't breathe, can't see? What do you expect him to do, and then what's that going to do to the productivity and the efficiency of every single other person in that class?
Right, and the teacher, you know, who can't – it's impossible for any teacher just to focus on the 3 R's. I mean, the lives of the kids are there. So a lot of teachers' time has to be taken up in some way, shape, or form trying to help those kids. And the teacher doesn't have the equipment or the skills to help those kids. You've got to have – some of those health clinics that are out there serving neighborhoods in the schools. It's a wonderful thing.
And David Kirp, what are some of the results of schools that do involve health clinics?
Well, just think of yourself as a parent, a mom or dad who's working on a job. If, you know, your child has a dental problem or, you know, needs glasses or whatever, you got to take a day off to go to the doctor, to go to the dentist, and that's hard to do. You put the clinic in the school, the family's life, not just the kid's life, but the family's life is going to be a lot easier, a lot better, and the service is going to be a lot more effective. And the same is true for dealing with the kid's emotional problems. Teachers aren't equipped to handle those. If there's a social worker or a psychologist around, can talk to children. They can bring families in, and so you can have family conferences with somebody who can actually help out in that situation.
Yeah, you know, the other thing I hear is that if you flip this around and you said, let me see, how do we help? Where would be the best place to put a clinic if we wanted to help kids' health? I mean, not looking at it as how do we help the school, but if we wanted to improve the community health, you'd put it in a school. And if we wanted to help community mental health, where would we put it? We'd put it in a school. It just makes so much sense.
Absolutely. And also, I'm glad you used the word community, because it's not just those clinics can serve the community, you know, even as they're serving kids. So, you know, and every, you know, there isn't a place in the country. School is the one thing you know is going to be found. And it can be a lot friendlier place than the doctor's, you know, offices in the health clinic. It can be a lot more inviting for lots of people. You
I remember
families into the school, and you strengthen the connection.
You strengthen the community. I was going to say, I remember in the early 90s meeting Bill Milliken, who'd started Cities and Schools, which I notice has changed its name now to Communities and Schools, which I guess just means they've spread to rural areas. But that whole notion of, as you said, the school is the thing that is in every community. So why not make it a place where the whole community, you've paid for the real estate, you've paid the utilities, you got the parking lot. Why not make it a place where there's health clinics, there's parent education, there's enrichment programs, et cetera?
communities and schools is a great program, and it's worth noting that the person who brought more community schools to his city than anybody else was Arne Duncan when he was the superintendent in Chicago. And I can only hope that, you know, and he understood all the points that we're making. I only hope that he can go back to that message, you know, in the coming years as we're talking about changing the underlying No Child Left Behind legislation, that the community doesn't get left out of that.
That's right. Yeah, it should be no community left behind. David Kirp, in your book, Kids First, let's talk about number four big idea, access to caring and stable adult mentors.
When I talked to people who work with kids and I said, what's the most important thing you could do for a child? The phrase caring and stable adult came out so often that I thought, God, this has got to be a talking point that some version of Karl Rove has produced. But no, when you were inviting me to blather on about my own background, you asked about mentors, and I started thinking about those people and how important they are. And I expect if your listeners now sort of think back over their own lives and why they are where they are, the same thing will be true. Having a champion, a mentor in your life, someone who you can turn to, someone who can show you alternative futures, someone who isn't a parent, but is someone who is supporting parents, is another adult in the lives, adolescents who just report that they crave that kind of assistance and attention, that person can make all the difference in the world, particularly for adolescents for whom we don't know a lot of programs that really work well for them. We do know that mentoring, championing really does matter. And the most famous of those programs, and still perhaps the best, is Big Brothers Big Sisters. Another is 4-H, which provides a different kind of mentoring. Also a big and demonstrably effective program.
And Experience Corps is a feeder to this?
Experience Corps is a different kind of mentoring. Experience Corps brings seniors the really untapped resource in this area.
Remember right.
I talked about how do you expand programs? 10,000 people every day are becoming 60. That's the end of the baby boomers. And those folks, when you ask them, say, we want to give back, and we want to give back to kids. So there really is an untapped group of people, and Experience Corps begins to tap those folks. They work in the schools from kindergarten through third grade, helping children who've got reading problems and, you know, of course, helping them in a whole bunch of other ways and forging the kind of connections that those children may very well not have. And again, you know, here the measure of success is how well are these kids doing in reading, and the gains are enormous. And we know how important it is that children read by third grade. I mean, that really is one of the primary markers for success in school. If you can't read by third grade, you are 8 times more likely to drop out of school. So what they are doing and what the seniors are doing is hugely important.
Okay, and then I want to mention and recommend a book. Earlier this week, I saw John Prendergast speak at in town here in L.A. He has a book called Unlikely Brothers. Do you know about this book, David?
I don't.
Ah, well, John is a human rights activist who's been active in Africa for many years. He started Enough, that project. But he also has a story about children that he has mentored through Big Brothers Big Sisters. John is kind of a force of nature. He's just full of the most amazing, you know, sort of love and authenticity on stage that you can imagine. But the book really tells a story of someone who – what happened in that case, I will just go through it quickly, is that he – there was a period where he was in Africa so much of the time that he no longer could provide the mentoring. The primary child he was mentoring got mixed up in drugs, got mixed up in crime, spent time in jail. Then they came back together. Both of them now are adults. Both of them are living well, and they co-wrote the book. So Unlikely Brothers by John Prendergast and Michael Maddox.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. And I briefly want to mention Friends of the Children, which I know a lot about. Friends of the Children is a program where they pick kids at risk but with potential in kindergarten or first grade. They match them with a paid professional who will spend 4 hours a week, 52 weeks a year until they graduate high school. It costs about $100,000 from the time that kid is in first grade to when they graduate per child, but the payoff is amazing.
It's a total game changer. I mean, because Friends of the Children is cherry picking in reverse. It's picking the kids who are who everybody can see are most likely to have trouble later on if they don't get help. And as you say, it's a really intensive relationship with a professional who's trained to work with kids. And it's not as though one person stays with them for 12 years, although that may happen, but it's that there is somebody, an adult in their lives in an intense way for that period of time. These are kids, you know, they come from families where typically dad is in prison. Nobody has graduated from high school in the family. They're just, mom was, they had teen moms. And these kids are overwhelmingly graduating from high school. They're staying out of trouble with the law. They're not getting pregnant. They're the wastebasketed kids who are going to make it in this generation. And again, if you do that cost accounting that we were talking about earlier, the benefits are calculated at three or four times the cost.
I have one statistic here that said the Oregon Harvard Business School Association found the societal benefits derived from greater educational achievement and lower rates of incarceration in teen motherhood 6-1.
That's a study of Portland, and there are other studies coming out from New York and other programs across the country. The shame is that because it's so expensive and because it takes a long time, it's been hard for that program to raise funds.
That's right. People look at where they're going to put. The benefits are phenomenal. I mean, just the thing you said, 60% of the students in Friends of the Children have at least one parent who's been incarcerated. 92% of them have escaped the juvenile justice system. 61% of the girls in the program were born to unwed teenage mothers. Only 2% became teen mothers themselves. David Kerp, we're talking about your book, Kids First, 5 Big Ideas for Transforming Children's Lives and America's Future. The fifth idea, providing children with a nest egg to help pay for college or start a career. Because this one may sound so outlandish to people, start off by telling people that they've done it in other countries and it works.
Yeah, they did it. It was universal policy in Britain for 10 years until the Cameron government took office, and it did work. And what work means is this is not a handout program to families. For poor families, the program says, okay, if you contribute as much as $500 a year, we, the government, will chip in with another $500 a year. And poor families actually do this. That's what the British evidence shows, and that's what some of the American studies show. It's been an idea that's been on the agenda in Washington for a long time. And interestingly, it gets a lot of conservative support, as well as liberals think of it as an equal opportunity approach, and conservatives think it's a way of training future capitalists.
That's right.
They're both right.
Exactly.
Because I just want to make one more point about it. What's valuable is not only that it gives you a nest egg, it changes everybody's view of what the future could be like. Kids, if they had the kind of supports that we've been describing and that I talk about in Kids First, they get to high school. They're poor kids. They look at college. They see the cost is, and they get sticker shock. You have this kind of a nest egg. It really helps you get over that, but it also makes families more attentive to kids' futures because they see that they've got futures, and it makes kids so much more money savvy. They see those statements, those investment statements, coming in, you know, 4 times a year, and they're 8, 9, 10, 11 years old, and they start paying attention because it's their money that we're talking about.
Okay, so I'll tell you what. We've only got basically 2 minutes left. So where I was going to go into some questions about the big picture, I'm going to give you my idea of the big picture as I read your book and thought about it. Why can't this be the basis for a national campaign that goes beyond left and right? Could Kids First be positioned as a matter of national security, like the interstate highway system or the internet or NASA? If we could marshal all the evidence, especially all those cost-benefit analyses, the 17-1, the 6-1, the 2-1, show that this is the wisest investment we could make as a nation, shouldn't that overcome some of the habitual resistance and opposition from business folks and the right? And here's my vision. Even in this time of government deficits, position it as a necessary investment in national security, and either as national security, you take cuts in defense spending and earmark them for investment or children, or highlighting investment, you put a tiny tax on speculation, the Tobin tax over in Europe, a tiny tax on speculation, and earmark that for investment in children. It seems to me that strategically, you win over some key players first, the Gates, the Buffetts, the Jobs, the Google folks, religious leaders, former senators and presidents, so that you've kind of disarmed the opposition before you unveil it, and then you go after business, media, unions, politicians, and it is all about investment. We are falling behind China. We're falling behind Germany. We've got this economy that was built on a bubble, and we cannot afford the luxury we used to have of not investing in our children, and we just make it a national campaign.
I love that idea. We're at a time when everybody is hunkered down. They're trying to save the last dollar. You know, the reason for my writing the book was to get people to think big. You have really developed a strategy that would give teeth and operational structure to how it is that one gets big. And there is no better investment in our future. Whether you think of this as a moral proposition, we need to be good stewards for the next generation, or a straightforward economic proposition, we're going to fall behind if we don't do this. It's just critical.
And I want to talk to you more about it, David. So I'll get back to you after this. Again, the book is Kids First.
That.
5 Big Ideas for Transforming Children's Lives and America's Future. To learn more, you go to berkeley.edu or huffingtonpost.com and type in David Kirp, K-I-R-P. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. You can do either of those things at iTunes or at my website, terrencemcnally.net. Or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're both the same site. You can also sign up at my site or by emailing me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com, to get a weekly announcement that tells you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and some background articles on the issues. Thanks to Jeff, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi and Mark Maxwell in production, Matt Perez in traffic, to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week. Have a great week. And finally, thank you to David Kirp. Keep up the good work.
You're not going to go there, are you?
Oh, yes, I am.
Hey, it's Carell, and you can go there with me each and every weekend here on the Progressive Voices Network, heard at progressivevoices.com or in the TuneIn app. And, of course, at my website, I Am Carell, and my app, The Carell Cast. Now, here's a little sample of what you'll be getting. And Angelo Caruso, an executive vice president of Media Matters for America, is here with us. It always scares me when I hear something from Bill O'Reilly and Eric Prince, who may be hot, but I'm outside of wanting to, you know, have dark alley sex with them. I wouldn't want to do much else. So when I agree with them, it scares me, and I always have to talk myself out of it. Now, what O'Reilly and Mr. Prince, who has made billions, I would probably imagine, off of war, they suggested a mercenary army to go in and fight ISIS as opposed to a national army, mean instead of the United States and France and others sending in actual troops, we send in Blackwater Z, which it's now called, and other organizations like it to do our fighting for us. When I heard that, I thought, why not? Why not? This is a ground urban war with a group of gangs. It's not against a nation. It's not a traditional war like war used to be. So why fight it traditionally? Now, I have to ask you, since we use private contractors already and did in Iraq and do in Afghanistan, why is it such a far stretch to simply say, okay, let's let this one be fought simply by the private contractors?
It's a good question. I mean, because, you know, intuitively, it sounds like it makes a lot of sense, right?
That's what scared me. It does sound, you're right. That's what the problem is. To me, as an American, right, tired of war in the Middle East, and knowing the confines of fighting a group like ISIS, which doesn't have offices like the Pentagon, we're bombing people's houses and office buildings and, you know, that sort of thing. I know that a police force is pretty inept against gangs. And the Army and the Marines and military is pretty much like a police force. And so why not send in private contractors?
So there's a couple of reasons here, and I think this is a good discussion to have. I mean, I'd point out that...
Let's stop right here, yeah, and let's talk about why we're talking about it. It is a good discussion to have, Angelo Caruso, Executive Vice President of Media Matters. What Bill O'Reilly had with this guy was not a good discussion about this. It wasn't a leveraged debate with people on both sides talking about why it may or may not be a good thing to use private contractors this time around. What it was O'Reilly and this prince basically saying that mercenaries are as American as they can, you know, we've always had them, and there's no point to not just jump right in now.
That's right. That's exactly right.
So tune in every weekend here at ProgressiveVoices.com or in the TuneIn app or in my app, The Carell Cast, and at my website, iamcarell.com. Carell.com. Carell.com.